You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the November 2023 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part A. Here's the continuation of The Moonshot by Joe Nocera and Bethany McLean. Pfizer announced the good news on November 9, 2020, a week after the presidential election. The following Sunday afternoon, November 15th, Moderna learned that the efficacy of its vaccine was nearly identical to Pfizer's. For a brief moment, the country was euphoric at the news. Fauci called the results just extraordinary. The New York Times called it an historic turning point, and the Washington Post called it a pharmaceutical industry fairy tale. The markets reacted joyously. The S&P had its best November since 1928. Both Pfizer's and Moderna's stocks soared. "I'm an ornery cynic," says one Wall Street trader who had previously bet against Moderna's stock. "But thank God for the believers, the people who are willing to fund companies like this." Alas, it wasn't long before people were fighting over the vaccine. The earliest fights were over which groups should get the first doses. In those early days, vaccine availability was limited. Progressives wanted people of color to be first in line because they had suffered disproportionately from the pandemic. Public school teachers believed they should go first. If teachers weren't vaccinated, they would continue to teach remotely, said many union leaders. The CDC recommended that healthcare workers and the elderly get priority, which, for the most part, they did. There were, of course, some failures and setbacks. Both Johnson & Johnson and AstraZeneca had to pause their clinical trials. Several participants came down with rare blood clotting disorders. While both vaccines were eventually approved, the news about blood clots steered most people away from those two companies. As for Novavax and Sanofi, scientific glitches outside Warp Speed's control caused the companies to delay their request for emergency use authorization until 2022. For the most part, their vaccines are being used abroad. The initial distribution of the vaccine went less smoothly than its production had. Part of the problem was that Operation Warp Speed decided it had to delegate distribution to the states. After all, the Warp Speed officials weren't supposed to be involved in the fraught decisions about who should get vaccinated first. There was also an unusual glitch by Perna's team when more than 10 states discovered that their allocation of Pfizer's vaccine was much lower than they had been led to believe. Perna didn't duck. "It was a planning error," he said. "I am responsible." Saluy faced a reckoning of his own. In March 2021, soon after leaving his government post, he was fired as chairman of the board of Galvani Bioelectronics over sexual harassment allegations brought by a woman with whom he'd worked years before at GSK, which co-owns Galvani. Saluy did not deny the allegations and issued an apology. There was also criticism of the fact that Warp Speed didn't meet its goal of delivering 100 million doses by year's end. Its leaders say that it was more aspirational than anything else. Azar, borrowing from the management experts Jim Collins and Jerry Porras, called it a BHAG, a big, hairy, audacious goal meant to motivate people. "How do you define success?" says one of Warp Speed's senior leaders. "I knew we would never be able to get all the doses we wanted, but I was absolutely convinced that we would have enough doses for everyone in the U.S. by mid-2021. Which they did. The vaccine rollout also offered a striking contrast between the United States and Europe. It took Europe months longer before it had widely available vaccines. That's because European countries had contracted to purchase doses but hadn't done anything to spur manufacturing. Of course, the effort faced a host of new challenges as time went on. Effectiveness of the vaccines waned as new variants arose. Disinformation campaigns and anti-vax sentiment flourished, and some Democrats were loath to credit Trump. For its part, the incoming Biden administration said it would retire the name Warp Speed, citing the urgent need to address the failures of the Trump team approach to vaccine distribution. To those who had worked so hard to get the vaccines out quickly, the move was both dismissive and inappropriately political. By focusing solely on the job at hand, and by refusing to get distracted by politics, the Warp Speed team made vaccines available faster than anyone in human history, pulling off the one true triumph of America's battle against COVID-19 and saving millions of lives. Many things went wrong with America's response to the pandemic, but Warp Speed still stands as an unambiguous success. This article was from The Big Fail, What the Pandemic Revealed About Who America Protects and Who It Leaves Behind, by Joe Nocera and Bethany McLean, published October 17, 2023, by Portfolio, an imprint of Penguin Publishing Group, a division of Penguin Random House. Copyright 2023 by Joseph Nocera and Bethany McLean. Now here's the Proust questionnaire with an illustration by Ryan McCamus. Baz Luhrmann, the filmmaker on storytelling, restlessness, and finding the perfect man purse. What is your current state of mind? I'm oscillating between the joys of playing hooky from responsibilities and a desperate need to take on new creative responsibilities. What is your favorite occupation? I don't know. What I do is all I've ever done. What is your most marked characteristic? Storytelling. When and where were you happiest? In Paris, with people I love. What is your most treasured possession? The perfect merce. If you could change one thing about yourself, what would it be? I wish I could be less restless. What do you consider the most overrated virtue? Seriousness. What is your greatest regret? I am sincerely devoted to not having regrets. What is your idea of perfect happiness? To love and be loved in return. What is your greatest fear? Not to love and not to be loved in return. What is the trait you most deplore in yourself? Overscreeding. What is the trait you most deplore in others? Duplicitousness. Who are your favorite writers? Huxley, Garcia Marquez, Shakespeare, Tolstoy, Molière, Fitzgerald, to name but a few. I just don't really believe in list when it comes to art. How do you compare Tolstoy to Murakami? They are both just great writers. What is your greatest extravagance? My children. What is your favorite journey? Any that I'm about to take. Which words or phrases do you most overuse? Do you know where my whatever is? What or who is the greatest love of your life? Catherine Martin and my two children. What are your favorite names? Ones that truly evoke people's character. What do you regard as the lowest depth of misery? To be unloved and lonely. What do you most value in your friends? Loyalty. Who is your favorite hero of fiction? I love heroic characters who embody the Greek quality of pathos. What is it that you most dislike? Mediocrity and boredom. What is your motto? A life lived in fear is a life half lived. Which living person do you most despise? Despising is a waste of time. Which talent would you most like to have? Beach, the ability to spell. Where would you like to live? Since childhood, I have forever been journeying down the yellow brick road, living in as many different countries and places as I can. I am endlessly excited by being in a new, unexplored place. And that was the Proust questionnaire with Baz Luhrmann. hip-hop's Renaissance man. He was a graffiti art pioneer, denizen of CBGB, friend of Basquiat, collaborator with Blondie, and host of the show that helped turn hip-hop global. On the 40th anniversary of Wild Style, the cult film that made him famous, Fab Five Freddy Takes Stock, by Mark Brazzo, with photographs by Eric Johnson, styled by Miles Pope. Opening photo, still Fab. Fred Brathwaite, Fab Five Freddy, in his Harlem home with a velvet print from his series on boxer Jack Johnson. On a Sunday afternoon in June, inside a cavernous warehouse in the Gowanus section of Brooklyn, the 40th anniversary of Wild Style, the 1983 film that did more than any other to frame, codify, and promote the culture now known as hip-hop, was celebrated as the climax of the weekend-long Five Points Festival. It felt as if an old-school Bronx block party had been transported to 21st century Brooklyn. The guy manning the turntables, that would be Grand Wizard Theodore, the DJ widely credited with inventing scratching, the revolutionary technique that defined early hip-hop. The PA was set to a decibel level somewhere between a jackhammer and a Boeing 787. The director of Wild Style, Charlie Ahern, a wiry guy with white hair and a friendly pink face, dressed head to toe in red, milled around, receiving hugs from an expansive retinue of early hip-hop heroes who had appeared in the movie. There was Grandmaster Caz of the Cold Crush Brothers, Crazy Legs from the Rocksteady Crew, one of the original B-Boys, and MC Busy Bee Starsky, the chief rocker himself, who still somehow looked like a teenager. Members of the Fantastic Five hammed it up as a phalanx of iPhones flashed in their faces. Soon enough, all of them were arrayed on stage, seated at a long table. It looked like a hip-hop Last Supper, but in actuality, it was something more akin to a rock and roll Hall of Fame moment. You couldn't help but think that here were the Little Richards and Chuck Berrys of rap. They were joined by Patty Astor, the art house Kim Novak of the early 80s, who starred in Wild Style as a hip downtown reporter, fascinated by graffiti, rap, and breakdancing. That was the triumvirate of urban pursuits, then coming into their own as art forms, chronicled in Wild Style, a sui generis melding of scripted drama and verite documentary. Smack in the middle of this assemblage sat Fred Brathwaite, better known as Fab Five Freddy, also known as Fab Five Freddy, using the numeral five. The artist, rapper, video director, documentary maker, podcaster, cannabis entrepreneur, and former longtime host of Yo! MTV Raps, who happens to be the person who first synergized the aesthetic elements, art, music, dance, that we all call hip-hop. Introducing the movie's luminaries, Master G of the Sugar Hill Gang declared Brathwaite the engine of Wild Style, which he called the greatest hip-hop movie in the history of hip-hop. It was Brathwaite who'd proposed to Ahern the idea of a hip-hop movie. Ahern, in turn, cast him as Fade, a slick-talking, scene-stealing impresario. Given his natural gift of gab, Brathwaite couldn't help but be the center of attention. At 64, he retains much of his familiar mien from the MTV glory days, ball cap, sunglasses, knowing grin, smooth delivery. He's tall and rangy, although the well-curated stubble on his cheeks is now silver. His energy level remains engine-like. When he came off stage after being presented with a red satin Wild Style jacket, care of the National Hip Hop Museum in Washington, D.C., he was swarmed. Sharpies were thrust upon him, and he graciously signed records, posters, even somebody's Nikes. He shrugged apologetically and made a good-natured aside about the autograph people. he was perhaps protesting too much. Just then, another well-wisher, a guy with graying hair who looked like he could have been at a hip-hop party or two in the South Bronx back in the day, bounced up to Braithwaite and announced, so that everyone around could hear, "This man's a genius." Considering the breadth of Braithwaite's free-ranging polyglot career and the fact that it's still in progress, it can be hard to sum up just what that genius is and why it still matters. He's some kind of cultural entrepreneur, you know. Chris Stein, a co-founder of Blondie, put it this way when I ask about the man his band name-checked in their 1980 hit Rapture, the first Billboard number one to feature rapping. "Fab Five Freddy told me everybody's fly." He's a linking figure, Stein emphasized. He was able to approach all these different worlds. Debbie Harry, Blondie's lead singer, told me he's a facilitator. He makes it easy for people to understand each other. It was Braithwaite, Harry suggested, who likely first exposed Blondie to rap. The pioneering rap artist Grandmaster Flash put it succinctly. Fab was the liaison between whites downtown and this black culture in the Bronx. A cross-pollinator, adept at bringing creative communities together. The art dealer and curator Jeffrey Deitch, whose Soho Gallery will host a Wild Style anniversary exhibition starting November 11th, told me that Fab Five Freddy's impact in the late 70s and early 80s was transformative, representing the meeting of the birth of hip-hop music, breakdancing, graffiti, a connection between street culture and art school culture. And that's what took over the entire world. This is world culture now. More than anyone else, that's Fred. He was the guy who put things together. Braithwaite grew up in Bedford-Stuyvesant, Brooklyn. His father was an accountant and jazz fan, and his mother was a nurse. When I recently met up with him in his old neighborhood, he mentioned that his sister still lives in the family townhouse on Hancock Street, where Braithwaite spent his boyhood in a bedroom on the top floor. He also told me that Max Roach, the jazz drummer, was his godfather. "He and my dad grew up together," Braithwaite said, noting that the two of them were pals at Boys High in Brooklyn and remained lifelong friends. He was always around. Conversations at the Braithwaite dinner table were a little out of the ordinary, too, as topics might include Charlie Parker, dialectical materialism, or Malcolm X, whose assassination Fred's father witnessed. Braithwaite inherited a reel-to-reel tape recording of the murder. Since 2019, this artifact, among 129 boxes of materials known as the Fab Five Freddy Papers, has resided in the New York Public Library Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture. We strolled around the old Brooklyn stomping grounds, with Braithwaite pointing out his favorite aunt's apartment and the house of a kid he knew who kept a pigeonaire on the roof. As Braithwaite spoke, a window opened onto the bedsty of the 60s and 70s, of young people cultivating pigeon flocks and running wild, playing ringolevio and stickball. "All of this street life ended," Braithwaite said, "when the crack epidemic swept through in the 80s. As we turned down Stuyvesant Avenue in Tony Stuyvesant Heights, he detailed how, as a boy, he was greatly perplexed that the residents here all seemed to have lighter complexions. It was a hard lesson to absorb about socioeconomics and racism. At Holy Rosary Elementary, the only trouble he got into stemmed from an incident in which he broke into the communion wafer cache and gulped down 50 at one sitting, testing a hypothesis that megadosing on the body of Christ might impart superhero-level spiritual effects. The nuns were not amused. Holy Rosary is now a luxury apartment building. Braithwaite paused on the sidewalk, blinking up at the building's gothic exterior. "This is a semi-out-of-body experience standing here," he said. Young Fred was attuned to art and music, and there was plenty of both to feast upon. The family turntable was piled high with bebop records, Thanks to his father's involvement in the jazz scene, his mom was more into Dinah Washington. Braithwaite remembers encountering Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin, and James Brown at a young age. By the early 1970s, he became a zealot for DJ Frankie Crocker's pioneering radio show on New York's WBLS. Frankie Crocker would play the hottest black music, soul music, funk music, from Barry White to Parliament, Braithwaite said. He also recalled how a roving posse of mobile DJs would come to Bed-Stuy, spin the latest funk and disco, and get a party going right there in the street. This is the thing that also inspired Kool Herc, he said, citing the DJ credited with sparking, in 1973, the thing that would become hip-hop. The uptown sound is what Braithwaite learned to call this nascent beat-heavy genre. In his companionable podcast, 50 Years of Hip-Hop, which debuted in February, Braithwaite dilates upon mobile DJs and related matters. In the meantime, Braithwaite had been noticing graffiti tags, the writer's signatures, proliferating around the city. This was the era of Tacky 183, the elusive Greek-American tagger who is considered New York's graffiti godfather. Braithwaite was fascinated. To him, graffiti was a teenager street activity, a game not unlike Rengolevio. He wanted to play. One day, while he sat in a classroom at John Dewey High School, he looked out the window at the massive Coney Island train yard next door. We referred to it as the layup, where the trains lay, he said. I took some paint out of shop class, found there was a hole under the fence I could slide under, and in between class periods, I went and did my name on a couple of trains. It happened that the first trains Braithwaite tagged went along elevated lines. Guys in my neighborhood went bananas, he said. Among his early tags were Bull 99 and Showdown 177. Braithwaite enjoyed the instant recognition. He was now part of a growing subculture of young New Yorkers bringing art to the streets, while City Hall went into a moral panic about spray paint. During this time, Braithwaite would bag school and roam around the Metropolitan Museum of Art. He began thinking about graffiti in art historical terms and recognized theoretical links between the unaffected street-level expression of graffiti and the conceptual high-end art world, Russian constructivism, abstract expressionism, pop. One graffiti writer seemed a cut above the best, a cut above the rest, rather, a Lower East Sider named Lee Quinones, who worked large-scale on handball courts, a level that Braithwaite knew he could never reach. Braithwaite decided to befriend him. He figured out what high school Quinones went to, dropped by his classroom, and asked to speak with him. Quinones, assuming Braithwaite was a cop, was terrified. An enduring friendship was born. Braithwaite fell in with Quinones' Fabulous Five crew, adopting the variable handles Fred Fab Five and Fab Five Freddy. He began working in Quinones' ratty studio under the Manhattan Bridge, and in 1979, the two of them pulled off something nearly unimaginable, a gallery show in Rome. It was Braithwaite who'd read the Zeitgeist and figured there could be a place for graffiti in contemporary art. As Quinones later put it, Fab is a genius at having his finger on the pulse. Braithwaite had by then aborted his career at Medgar Evers College in favor of the higher education attained by schlepping into Manhattan on the A train. Through a Quinones friend, he scored a fifth-generation cassette of a rapper from the Bronx called Grandmaster Flash, and on the Bowery, he became enthralled by upstart punk rockers such as the Cramps and Richard Hell. CBGB was effing raging, he recalled. Punk and New Wave were a world away from mobile DJs, but Braithwaite sensed an unlikely synergy. I remember the first time going into the CB's bathroom. Graffiti was everywhere, even in the effing toilet, in the urinal. I had this realization like, yes, there is a connection here between the aesthetics of punk and new wave and the energy of graffiti. Stein and Harry remember first meeting Braithwaite at CBGB. All of a sudden, this very tall black man was hanging out, Harry recalled. He had a magnetic thing about him. Around 1979, he cold-called Glenn O'Brien, an editor and music columnist at Warhol's Interview magazine, who was hosting the after-hours cable access talk show TV Party, a kind of punk Fernwood Tonight. In no time, Braithwaite became Braithwaite became a guest on the show as well as a cameraman, lack of experience perhaps being a selling point. Joining an extended TV Party family that included the likes of Stein, the show's co-host, Harry, Klaus Nomi, and James Chance, along with a new pal, the graffiti artist Samo for Same Old Shit, whose given name was Jean-Michel Basquiat. Braithwaite and Basquiat, who'd first encountered each other at an art space called the Canal Zone, made an obvious pairing. Both of them young, charismatic, good-looking, black middle-class Brooklynites with accountant fathers making a splash in a largely white Manhattan scene. Braithwaite found that O'Brien et al. Were receptive to his ideas about graffiti and art. It inspired Braithwaite to step up his game, and in 1979, the same year of the Rome Gallery show, he created the statement piece that defined his graffiti career. He racked up a ton of red and white spray paint, and with help from Quiñones, blanketed the entire side of a subway car on the Five Line with an image of Campbell soup cans, working large like his friend. Braithwaite's mobile homage to Andy Warhol elicited applause from passengers when it rolled into stations. The authorities quickly buffed the original soup cans car, but Braithwaite did a second one the following year. The fact that Fred painted Campbell's soup cans on a train cannot be underestimated, Ahern said. By 1980, there's a growing sense that this thing on the subways is art. So that statement was a perfect signature, because Warhol wasn't original either. Preoccupied, as usual, with the relationship between street art and high art, Braithwaite had discerned a shared visual language between graffiti and 1960s pop art. Graffiti artists were looking at comics, looking at soapbox ads with bright colors, he said, citing influences that propelled both art movements. We wanted shit to pop off the trains in the basic primary colors. We fell in, organically inspired by the same thing that pop art had been inspired by a decade or so earlier, so I was like, wow. A framed photograph of Braithwaite and Warhol together on the town hangs on the wall of Braithwaite's parlor in Harlem, where since 1999 he's lived in a 19th century Sugar Hill townhouse. The place once belonged to George Edmund Haynes, a founder of the Urban League. W.E.B. Du Bois and Billie Holiday are said to have been visitors. With its dark wainscoting and carved doors, it's easy to imagine the house as a Harlem Renaissance salon, a spirit that Braithwaite continues by hosting artists and filmmakers, writers and musicians. In 2017, Columbia University Press published a book about the house called Down the Up Staircase. Braithwaite, who is single and the father of a 20-something daughter named Sparkle, she is repped by Wilhelmina Models, has a decorating style that runs toward objets that draw the eye and ignite conversation. The first thing you see when you step inside is a painted portrait of Quiñones. There are outsized photos of Biggie Smalls, assorted piles of memorabilia, posters for Wild Style and Grass is Greener, his 2019 Netflix documentary about cannabis, of which Braithwaite is a great proponent, and a fleet of remote control model race cars, which kept him occupied during the pandemic. By his own account, Braithwaite gave up outdoor graffiti in 1980. He'd begun to bristle at the perception that he and his cohort were street urchins and juvenile delinquents. In June of that year, he managed to get his work into the era-defining month-long Times Square show, which was to the 1980s New York art world what the 1913 Armory Show was to an earlier time. There he met Ahern, whose twin brother, John, had been instrumental in assembling the exhibition. Braithwaite had seen posters for Ahern's art film, The Deadly Art of Survival, and was obsessed. The meeting felt like cosmic kismet. They were like two peas in a pod, Quiñones said during a Q&A after a screening of Wild Style at the 2023 Tribeca Film Festival. When I asked Ahern about his first impression of Braithwaite, he told me he was like a heat-seeking missile. It was at the Times Square show that Braithwaite laid his idea of an art house movie about graffiti, rap, and breakdancing on Ahern. Damn, put this all in a movie, it would be dope. By yoking art, music, and dance together, they wouldn't be isolated youth phenomena so much as a full-blown unified culture, a movement. It turned out that Ahern had been thinking it would be dope to put Quiñones in a movie. The young graffiti artist would, in fact, become the central character of Wild Style, a vulnerable, enigmatic, and uncompromising creator trying to be true to himself, a perfect symbol of the hopes and concerns of many young New Yorkers, often of color. Braithwaite and Ahern worked up their ideas for the film over pots of Bustelo at Ahern's place downtown and then ventured up to the Bronx to scout out a rap event. Maybe 75 people were there. The locals took them, a tall black guy and a short white guy, for two of New York's finest. Braithwaite and Ahern were astounded by the propulsive music and the entire scene, filled as it was with humor and spontaneity and a spirit of total freedom. Ahern approached MC Busy Bee Starsky, a conspicuous focal point, and said he'd like to put him in a movie. Busy Bee slung an arm around Ahern's shoulders, hauled him on stage, and announced to an ecstatic crowd, "This is my producer, Charlie Ahern, and we're making a movie about the rap scene." For Braithwaite, the early 80s rolled by in a montage, shooting Wild Style, appearing in Blondie's Rapture video, sharing a studio with Basquiat, shrooming with Keith Haring and Kenny Scharf, having his artwork cited by the poet John Ashbery in Newsweek, being photographed for Vanity Fair by an up-and-coming photographer named Nan Golden, releasing the occasional rap single, including Change the Beat, and night after night hanging out at the Mud Club, the Tribeca spot that countered Studio 54's uptown establishment excess with downtown bohemian cool. There, Braithwaite co-curated with the artist Futura 2000 a groundbreaking graffiti exhibition called Beyond Words. Bronx hip-hop scenesters gravitated toward the show, a more uptown-downtown intermingling. A lot of people got to experience all of this culture for the first time, Braithwaite observed, and they became fans. Wild Style finally came out in 1983, an instant cult classic, and the most authentic film portrayal of hip-hop's formative period. It inspired Hollywood knockoffs and raised the profile of Fab Five Freddy. He starred in the movie with its musical director, with Stein. He created the backing tracks used by the rappers and received credit with Ahern for the original concept. Given Braithwaite's stature as a rap renaissance man, his friend Peter Doherty, a producer at MTV, floated the idea a few years later that he should host a rap show on the Music Channel. Braithwaite was excited but taken aback. He wasn't a television personality, and he didn't think he could live up to the example of his WBLS hero, Frankie Crocker. More to the point, he thought MTV and its host were lame. "I didn't want to be like those typical VJs that would be on for 4 hours straight," he said. "You'd be like, I hate this effing guy. Who are you, MF? Play the shit I want to hear." MTV, which had launched in 1981, was exceedingly white, at least until Michael Jackson and Prince became impossible to ignore. In a famously contentious MTV interview from 1983, David Bowie turned on VJ Mark Goodman, castigating him and the network for neglecting black artists. Braithwaite had his own term for it, television apartheid. Then, in 1986, Run-DMC lit a pop culture bonfire when they teamed with Aerosmith for Walk This Way. Suddenly, every suburban kid in America was into this rap stuff. But there was still no MTV programming dedicated to it. Braithwaite noted that even black radio and television weren't supporting the genre. Rap was a fad. It wasn't important. It wasn't music. Doherty kept at Braithwaite, shooting a demo of him in VJ mode, the difference being that Braithwaite refused to be stuck inside MTV's studios. He wanted to be out in the street, where hip-hop's energy came from. He wanted natural light and unscripted accidents a la TV Party, and he wanted to do anything he could to help young rap artists feel relaxed, many of them nervous as hell to be on TV, despite the put-on bravado. He channeled the hip-hop flaneur character he'd concocted for Wild Style. "I went into the persona," he told me. "And keep in mind, it was never my intention to be on screen and do any of this shit. Charlie talked me into being Fade. He would now deploy the Fade character, joke-cracking, loose-limbed, streetwise, a total operator, as an amped-up MTV version of himself. And so Fab Five Freddy was reborn as the original rap VJ. That's what the show really needed," Harry said, "and it certainly made MTV look like they were smart." Yo MTV Raps debuted in 1988, the same year Basquiat, at 27, died of a heroin overdose. The response to Braithwaite's new series was instant and huge. The highest ratings that MTV had seen is how Braithwaite remembered it. They literally thought something had happened with the Nielsen system. The show doubled the normal ratings in its time slot and quickly vied to become MTV's top program. Braithwaite also began directing rap videos, starting with Boogie Down Productions' My Philosophy, featuring KRS-One. Braithwaite would go on to host or co-host Yo MTV Raps until 1995, introducing audiences to the likes of Puff Daddy, Notorious B.I.G., Tupac Shakur, Queen Latifah, and Snoop Dogg, and inspiring radio to take up the hip-hop cause. During the show's seven-year run, Braithwaite helped rap evolve from the underground community depicted in Wild Style to the global cultural juggernaut we know today. Last summer, the music historian Jay Kwan bestowed unique status upon Braithwaite, proclaiming him to be the greatest hip-hop ambassador. The Yo MTV Raps period was plush for Braithwaite. He was everywhere. Susan Orlean profiled him in The New Yorker. The piece began, "The coolest person in New York at the moment is a man named Fred Braithwaite." That Braithwaite said impressed the F out of MTV CEO Tom Freston. Deitch recalled that heady time. "There was no money in any of this in the beginning. Then Fred's like the most prosperous guy in the scene with a car and driver running around, you know, a real rap star." Back in Bed-Stuy, his parents still didn't have cable. "I had to send VHS tapes to my family every week so they could see what I'm doing," Braithwaite said, "like, I'm on TV for real." Next photo, streetwise. Braithwaite on the steps of his Sugar Hill townhouse, once a hangout for the likes of W.E.B. Du Bois and Billie Holiday. When the MTV ride was over, Braithwaite kept motoring ahead, founding a record label, hosting a web-based show, and above all, returning to art. His most recent work, shown at London's Saatchi Gallery earlier this year, focuses on black pirates. The effect of these supercharged, large-scale images suggest N.C. Wyeth's Treasure Island illustrations being sent through a time machine to the edge of tomorrow. They have movie poster panache along with hip-hop swagger. Braithwaite executed them with digital technology, even a touch of AI. "I'm a romantic about the idea of painting and painters," he explained, "but I wanted to modernize my methods. So the idea of working digitally was appealing to me, and kind of cool, considering how hip-hop musically disrupted practices and techniques to create something new." Braithwaite sees his black pirates as a corrective to Eurocentric history that ignores the racial dynamics of high seas buccaneering during the era of the sugar trade. He will likely include more of this work in the Wild Style anniversary show at Deitch's Gallery, curated by Carlo McCormick, where he'll be joined by other artists featured in the movie, such as Quiñones, Lady Pink, and Ramelsey. Braithwaite's cannabis activism represents another corrective. His 2019 documentary Grass is Greener, featuring Chuck D and Snoop Dogg, is a repudiation of the racially tinged paranoia of old scare films such as Reefer Madness. The doc offers a new way of reading the story of cannabis, one focused on black creativity and social justice. At its heart is the harrowing saga of Bernard Noble, a Louisiana man who served 7 years in prison for possessing barely enough marijuana for two joints. In 2021, Braithwaite partnered with Noble and the cannabis company Curaleaf to launch Be Noble, a weed brand aligned with social equity and criminal justice reform. People of color have been disproportionately criminalized for this nonviolent cannabis plant, Braithwaite said. So we donate 10% of our revenue to organizations that are helping fight the harm and fix the harm caused. Up at his townhouse, Braithwaite showed off some Be Noble pre-rolls. They have names like Motor Breath and Sour Diesel, which sound like graffiti tags. When I asked what he had in mind to do next, he said, rather airily, "Projects have come and gone and more are coming, including more art, more TV and movie pitches, more hip-hop anniversaries to commemorate." "There's another chapter coming," Deitch said, "because there's always so much that he has going." You could say that Fab Five Freddy has always had another chapter coming, right from the beginning. I offered him a précis of the various ways he's already shaped our cultural reality, defining hip-hop, bringing graffiti into galleries, spreading the rap gospel around the world. I trailed off. Braithwaite adjusted the brim of his baseball cap and considered this for a few seconds. "Yeah," he said, "it still blows my mind." Hand That Rocked the Cradle, coming up in the next installment. That and more in the next podcast. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.